Hey, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello, welcome back to Dyson Jacks. I'm Tamar Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 7. Nasdaq Futures up 243. That's a big move. It's almost 1%. We had the NFL draft last night. We've got all kinds of news bouncing around today. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, good morning.
How are you? I can barely hear you. But
all right.
There you go. Now I can hear you. Yeah, everything's... So did you... What do you suppose people 100 years from now are going to look back at one of these draft nights and think about people today?
Or not?
I don't know. There's always somebody who wants to do some history.
Well, you're asking a question. So what is your commentary on it? Because that's really I think you're asking making a comment in the form of a question.
I just 50,000 people standing there listening to these idiots for 5 hours?
Yeah, well, I couldn't do it on TV, so I don't think I could do it in person.
I can't even...
But, hey, you know, who am I to criticize what people want to do for their entertainment? Let them. I got no problem with that.
Did they serve beer
not,
there?
Not what I do, but it's, you know, but so what?
Do they serve beer there? Are there enough bathrooms? I mean,
oh, I'm sure they do.
Well, I know when they did it in Chicago, I think they caught a good night. It was two nights. I think, didn't they take over the whole intersection at Michigan and Balbo or something?
I don't know, because I didn't live there at the time, so I paid no attention whatsoever.
It was like 3 years ago they hit it here.
Yeah, well, I still didn't live there at the time.
But, I mean, you wonder, you get 50,000 people standing there. It's like New Year's Eve at Times Square. You got to be there, like, 3 hours early. You got to go through metal detectors. They close off all, like, even the sewer covers. The restaurants won't let you in to take a pee. You can't drink. What do you do? I guess you may do it once just to say you did it, but, wow. I don't know, maybe I'm getting old, I don't know. But it's
well, it's an event. There's a lot of people that just like to be part of an event, whatever it is. That's one of my contentions about college basketball. Students aren't basketball junkies like they once were, but they show up for the big event games. You know, like at Notre Dame, they're not going to show up for anything other than Duke or North Carolina or somebody like that. But otherwise, they don't really show up. I think you see a lot of that. They'll be there for the big games, and they'll be acting like they've been fans all along. And it's the same thing for football. Football at Notre Dame is a big event every weekend. So that's a different issue. They're absolutely going to show up for that. I think that's a whole segment of society that says, if you want to have a big event, I'll be there. I'll be there to mingle, to be part of it. And, that's probably what you got going on with the draft. And the NFL has certainly managed to market it. They're selling that like they're selling football games, only it's, April, not during the season. So, for them, it's very clever.
It's really stunning. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you and I joust about and other people on the show talk about, a lot of it is, to me, is just the idea that we have the conversation is so fascinating. The decisions is whether people think one side or the other is right. But the entire, on the one hand, I look at it and I say, wow, this is kind of cool. People love to watch it, obviously. On the other hand, it's a cattle auction, for God's sake, where people are essentially being parceled off into places that in a non-competitive manner that is absolutely against any sort of free economic sort of thing anybody ever believes in. I mean, if you ever had something like that for lawyers coming out of Harvard, people would be appalled. Oh, no, you get to go to this law firm in bumbleep Utah or something. I got to do what? I can't go where I want to go. But it's insane to me. And yet everybody, somehow you roll with it. And I'm trying to make an odd segue here, Kevin. I don't know if you were listening. And this is talk about something that is absolutely not, I'd say, non-party politics. This article written by Kyla Scanlon, one of the listeners sent me the other day. It's a New York Times article regarding why the stock market makes no sense right now. And it's funny because, I mean, she starts all the way back 1987 and how the Fed has constantly essentially saved the market, which is, you know, and you can go through every type of thing. You go through it this week, for God's sake, a couple stocks were going down, and all of a sudden, you certainly saw it during COVID, you saw it 2018, I mean, you saw it time and time again, to the point where it's so part of society that you look at it and you go, wait a minute, that's not what... Because the other side of the coin is, every time you do this, you pour money in the system, you create inflation, so you help some people and you hurt other people. And as time goes by, the other people maybe don't even realize it's happening to them. And on the other hand, have no voice to change it, to turn it around. I mean, right now, if you were to ask anybody in this absurd administration or the last absurd administration, would you trade a 10% move in the market for the people who got you here versus inflation being 2% for the rest of the people? First of all, they don't even think of it that way. But if they did, they'd say absolutely yes. And yet the other people, the 2% that are getting shoved up their behind, it's so gradual, and it's never pointed out by anybody that this is what's causing it. It's always, you know, these dirty Middle Easterners, or it's somebody. It's the damn farmers. It's the fertilizer price. It's always some bullshit that there's never even a voice on the other side. Like last night, I mean, there's nobody that comes out on TV and says, you know how absurd this is, that an economic thing that people get selected into companies. It's so bizarre that it kind of gets that way, and yet it is. It just is. I mean, I guess, what can I say? It is.
Yeah. So why do you suppose the NFL does it that way? Forget, you know, anything else. What is the philosophy behind doing it?
Well, the NFL has...
Because this does answer your question about how absurd it is. Whether, you know, and it certainly is absurd. I can't imagine, coming out of college with a business degree and having somebody say, well, you got drafted by XYZ company. Why does the NFL want to do it that way?
Well, I mean, anybody would want to. I mean, if you had the seven.
No. But why? What's the reason?
Okay. The perfect example would be when they had the seven CPA firms. Now we're down to four or whatever. They'd love to do that. It absolutely lowers wages, right? Well, you can only negotiate with one place.
Do you think the draft started to lower wages?
In the beginning, probably. I mean, there's competitive things in there. There's stuff that a monopolist would want. There's a lot of reasons why the NFL would want to do it. Maintain some kind of parity in their mind, lower the ability of somebody to go to another place and get a higher. You know, you would assume, you know, the counter argument would be, well, a team's not going to draft a quarterback if they don't need a quarterback. So in that regard, the guy's probably going to a place where he's needed.
Yeah. Tell it to the Rams, but yeah, go ahead.
But the other side of the coin is. And I will say this in defense of the NFL, which, you know, you got to give somebody good and bad. The fact that they've gone down to only seven rounds, I think, mitigates a lot of what I'm talking about, Kevin, to a certain extent. Because the people that are the fringe players, the person like, I had breakfast with David John's brother Pete when he was being drafted or was eligible for the draft. He says, I hope I'm not drafted. And I go, this is when they first went to seven, I think seven rounds. And he said, I said, why? He said, well, I'm not a star. He said, if I get to choose a team, I would want to go to a place with a 3-4 set, and I would be the guy, was it the inside, weak side, something, something, where your main job is either chasing somebody out or pass protection, because that's what I'm really good at. I'm not, if I get drafted by the Bears, I'm not Butkus, I'm not Bill George, I'm not big enough to take on a guard, shake him off, and then go get the running back. It was, that's just not me. So for me, the last thing I'd want to do is be drafted by the Bears, get my head beat in training camp, and then get cut. And then have to go find somebody after training camp. So that's why I have a much bigger problem with Major League Baseball, like 30 rounds. Hell, that's 900 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't have as big of a bitch with the NFL. But this principle,
and in the NFL, they typically don't draft players who don't fit their systems, whatever their
right.
systems.
So I mean, in the sense that, but now the fact that it's a big enough spectacle like last night, you're right. If people want to watch it, people want to go. You know, it's a little dose of football in the off season. I mean, hey, you know, anytime people, there's people that would say that we're a bunch of idiots for getting together to watch Notre Dame game with guys we've known for 20 years. Well, it's a reason to get together. So. The fact that people want to watch the draft or something, you know, I guess that's fine. So, I mean, the principle.
And I'll answer my own question. I think the initial reason, the initial driving reason, you can look at all the other reasons and say, yeah, all that too. But the initial reason was an attempt to try and have, parity in the league, that teams that suck have a chance to get better. But you're right about it suppressing salaries. We see that in college now where everybody's a free agent every year. You see what the impact of that is. So it does have all these other effects. But I think when the draft was originally invented, it was to allocate some of the talent so that some teams just didn't completely suck forever. Although it seems that the same teams do manage to suck forever anyway, because the reason they suck is that they're poor decision makers.
Well, yeah, and that sort of happens. When did this all sort of start? I mean, when the Bears drafted Butkus and Sayers in the first year, it was, where did they get those picks? I mean, they didn't trade for them, did they? I mean, I don't even remember, but back, I mean, the draft was there, but I don't know, people seemed to get people even if they weren't through the draft, wasn't it? I mean,
but they traded picks back then. That, you know, I don't know what the deal was that got them both Butkus and Sayers in the first round, but they were both in the first round.
But the Bears didn't suck.
A remarkably productive first round followed by didn't get anybody else in that draft.
Well, sure they did. They got Dick Gordon. They got Jimmy Jones.
Yeah. Okay. I guess so. I guess they got a few.
Plus
people.
They got the one guy, Steve DeLong, that ended up getting signed by the AFL and had a huge career. Was he a tackle or something?
Might have been,
but it's. I mean, I have a bigger complaint with Major League Baseball, because there are guys sitting on teams with four shortstops ahead of them, and there's other teams that could use them. And you're right, there is some sort of a after 5 years, you get to move a little bit in the minors. I don't know, Mandy Weber told me about that one day, but still, it's nowhere near the beauty of Major League Baseball. And Marvin Miller was a genius in regard to it when you talk to free agency in baseball. Well, first, the owners wanted to maintain control. So the free agency is very, very limited. So Marvin Miller talked him into this arbitration thing. I don't think I've ever, well, I'm sure if I looked around, I'd find one. I don't think there's a second-year economics student, if they even have those anymore, that wouldn't tell you that is the dumbest thing that the owners ever did. Because if everybody was a free agent, you'd have I use the term market price for a left fielder. Okay, and I won't say they're a dime a dozen, they're not, but you'd be able to say, okay, a guy was a scale of 1 to 10, a 7's worth this, an 8's worth this, like in regular business. But when Marvin Miller talked these idiots into doing, and I don't mean they're idiots as an individual, but
But they were idiots when it came to dealing with Marvin Miller, because the owners, all they ever wanted to do was beat Marvin Miller this time, and they never did.
Well, but the economic justification of only having 3 or 4 people or 10 people in play, like you might have one left fielder who's really good in play. Now, if he's the only guy available, for everybody to bid on, and everybody might, you know, and half the teams might need him, half might already have a left fielder. His value now, because he's the only one essentially at the auction, is going to be way higher than anybody else's.
Yeah, it's manufactured scarcity.
Yeah. So then when you look at that, and the other guy comes up next year for arbitration, he goes, wait a minute. A left fielder that hits 290 and hits 25 home runs is worth $5 million. I'm making one. I want five. And the judge goes, wow, it sure looks to me like the arbitrator.
Yeah, that looks like the going rate,
doesn't
it?
Looks like the going rate, doesn't it? I mean, it's insane how that would. And you wonder, Kevin, if all of a sudden in the minor leagues you just said, okay, after 1 year anybody can go wherever they want. I don't know if the prices would even increase, but you'd probably find somebody that makes it to a team where he could actually play. Right?
Well, yes, but at the same time, the idea that you go anywhere you want flies in the face of your standard complaint about college, where they invest in the development of the player and get nothing out of it.
Well, that's the truth. But you could sign a 2-year agreement or something. But right now, you can. How many people do you think? I used to walk in back when I was younger. I got to watch the Cubs in spring training. You know, this is in the 80s, and I was always kind of an interested sort. So, try and do this today, Kevin. I pull into Hohokam Field, which was in the middle of like a bunch of really nice soccer fields, and I do my running in the morning, which, you know, God, I don't think I could do that now. So I'd run all these 110-yard sprints, and then I'd hop in a car, put my jacket on, and go down the block to a Fitch Field, which is the minor league park. If you've never seen that, Kevin, you probably would understand it more than I would have because you played more hardball, but the choreography of a minor league team, even a major league team, all working out and how many people you can put on the same field if you do it right, it's really something. For those that don't know what I'm talking about, you have people doing batting practice. And you see those little circles to the right and left of home plate, and you wonder, what the hell are those things? Well, that's where the guys hitting the balls fielding practice stand. And the guy on the left side hits the balls to like the shortstop and second baseman. Now the pitcher who's pitching has a screen in front of him because the batter, you don't want to whack him with the batter. The first baseman has a screen in front of him because he's paying attention to catching the balls from the guys in the infield. And the guy's hitting batting practice to essentially the third baseman, second baseman, and shortstop. And there's like five guys lined up behind each guy taking turns on ground balls. Meanwhile, there's about 15 outfielders out there. And the guy in the other circle is whacking balls on fungos to the outfielders. And those guys are so good at it, it's scary. They never miss a ball. It always goes to the outfield. They don't hit a ground ball in the infield. They go right where the ball goes, right where they want it to go. And all this is going on all at the same time. In the meantime, you always see, every morning you'd see two or three guys with their bags, like walking into the clubhouse. They must have just been signed. You also see two or three guys walking out of the clubhouse with their bags, never to return.
They got the talk that Crash Davis gets at the end of Bull Durham. When
yeah,
Crash is the hardest thing a manager has to do.
Without a doubt, but it's the choreography of it, and we're plus there's a thing about young guys, or at least their impression of young guys. You keep these guys doing something all day long, Kevin. Now, you and I know we've played enough ball that if we wanted to really be, a lot of stuff you're doing is fielding round balls for other people that are hitting that kind of crap. It's like softball batting practice. Everybody else is out there just so the guy can hit. But you'll see, I'm talking 9 in the morning. These guys are out there, and then you'll see people jogging and playing catch, and you come by at 3 in the afternoon. They're still doing it. You and I know that if you really just wanted a workout, you'd go, you'd do your running, you'd do your stuff, you'd take your batting practice, you'd field 200 ground balls or whatever it is, and you'd do some other drills, and you're talking, what, 2 hours maybe? Yet they kept these guys occupied all day long. Not the pros so much, the major league team, but the other, because they didn't want them running around Arizona with nothing to do in the afternoon chasing God knows what. It's amazing how they kept them doing something all day long. Remember Jim Boughton's book about spring training, how he had to look busy all the time when there was nothing to do? What his solution was? He said he would go to the bullpen. He'd already done his pitching. He'd already done his running. And he'd stand around, and he'd kind of look like he was trying to do something. And finally, when he wasn't, I've seen people in business were masters at this. And he would say, okay. Then he would stride. He'd say, I tried purposefully toward the dugout, as if I had something to do when I got there. Then I'd hang around the dugout for a while, doing some stuff, checking some charts and all this kind of stuff. And when it was obvious they were there, I didn't do anything. I'd stride purposefully back to the bullpen. He goes, I did this all day. I had nothing to do. But I couldn't go anywhere.
That's funny.
How many times?
Have you ever watched a football practice when they were serious?
A little bit. I used to watch some of the Notre Dame stuff.
Yeah, that's a little bit different. Coaches have, you know, they have a timetable, and it's like everything's broken into 10, 15-minute segments. Every position, you know, has its agenda for the day. Head coach blows the whistle or somebody sounds the horn or something like that, and it's like, okay, we're done with that drill, on to the next one. And then, okay, now we're going to take, you know, we've been working out, now we're going to go take all the linemen over with the tight ends, and we're going to do to get something together. And that whole thing is choreographed. That is built to get a productive, you know, 2 hours or whatever, you know, whatever the amount is. It's all built around that.
But it's not all day.
It's not all day. It's a completely different approach to it. Now then they can have team meetings, you know, position group meetings, full team meetings. They can do, you know, workouts, you know, weight room and all that kind of stuff. But when they're on the field, it is all about, you know, squeezing productivity out of every last second.
It's got to be like taking an accounting class. I took an advanced accounting class downtown, Kevin, when there was no air conditioning, University of Chicago. It's a 150-minute class, which is cruel and unusual punishment to start. It'd be 10 to 10. And the guy'd finish some stuff, he'd look at his watch, and he goes, well, looks like we got 10 minutes. You start something else, and everybody in the place is like, oh, God. You get those guys, what do you mean? We got 10 more minutes. We can learn more accounting, and everybody else is sitting there, God, there's got to be a bar someplace.
I mean, yeah, I always have the opposite problem. I always have, about 20 pounds of material to squeeze into a 10-pound bag. And so I always have holdover for the next class. I have no problem filling up the class time
because I prep a lot of material. You've got to be easy to knock off topic.
I can be. Like last night, I definitely was. We spent the first half hour talking about, something that was completely off topic, but it was a very productive conversation, and the students were really interested. So I'm pretty good at, you know, I'll get back on topic. But yeah, a lot of times my students know exactly how to get me talking about something else, anything else. They figure that out about me pretty early on, and then they definitely know how to get me going.
Well, the class I took from Milton Friedman was the theory of price. He hated it, so he would love to get knocked off topic. The book he used was his manuscript because near the end he didn't even want to finish it, so it was like 90% done and was in paper copy. So he loved getting knocked off topic because he hated the subject, and so did we. So it was a perfect marriage.
Look, my philosophy for teaching a course is that there are a number of things. There's the course material, but you know everybody knows how to read, so they don't need me to spit that back at them in class. But there are a whole bunch of things that aren't on the course objectives. They're not in the syllabus. I tell them specifically, my job is to prepare you to be better professionals in your field. And so we're going to do some things that relate to that. Then I'm going to give you some different slants on what the course material is based on, you know, my own personal professional experience. And that's how I conduct my classes. So it really, the class itself is almost designed to get off topic.
Well, I'm kind of leading down this road for sort of a reason, but how does any of this stuff change? I haven't been staring at the interviews of the new, the alleged new Fed chairman. You know, the one guy's blocking a committee, and Powell says he might not leave, which will be interesting. I don't know how that's going to play out. On one hand, I wish he wouldn't leave just to piss everybody off. But on the other hand, I mean, what the hell? But, you know, I watched a few of the interviews from some of the senators, And you know, it's these things that are, maybe it's worse when it's on TV, because it's really all about the senator. It's not really about the interview, which is on both sides. You know, whether you're,
I saw a great observation about that, and they said, you know, that the administration it does everything. Congress is just a social media app.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know. You know,
and Hal's on. Hal, you can comment on that if you want.
Well, let me lob a question out there. But I, you know, this is an area, out of all the things in the world that you don't know about, I mean, don't ask me to take out your appendix. This is something I do know something about. And if it was me, you would think there would be some questions like, it looks like inflation has been out of control for a while. It looks like, you know, I would bring up some stuff, that, you know, the CPI, and I know you don't do the CPI. It's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's not your job to criticize them, but you're also supposed to be somebody with a brain. The CPI is here for the last whatever years. And by the way, if you look at individual stuff in there, it's 2 and 3 times that. Or you look at money supply growth. Even now, we have a Fed that's saying they're fighting money supply. And by the way, the numbers they give you, they're way higher than anybody fighting it. If you listen to Hal, which we will in a second, they're even higher than that. So what are you going to do about that? Do you agree with that? Is your policy going to change? You'll never hear that question. And when you're talking about a Fed chairman, and I go back to when Volcker was the guy, that would have been every single question. And what are you going to do?
Yeah. Tom, you're not going to get that question answered, though, as you see. But so you have to. You know, there's an art to asking questions that is much less confrontational and gets people talking about, you know, what, about their general beliefs, you know, the kinds of things where you can fill in the blanks based on what they say, and now you have an idea of what they're thinking and what they want to do. But when you ask a direct confrontational question to a politician, you're just not going to get an answer.
Well, I mean, if you don't ask, you don't get. But I mean, maybe you could do it nicer and say, okay.
It's not a matter of nice. It's a matter of, you know, it is something I learned in my side hustle days interviewing coaches in a setting. You get them to talk shop. You don't get them to. You don't ask confrontational, you know, direct questions, because then you get the BS answer. But if you if on the other hand. You can get them to talk about their approach to doing things. Just, you know, it's like talk shop is basically talk about your profession. Then you get an answer. Then you get an answer where you understand how they think, and now you're getting indirectly, you're getting an answer to the question.
The only difference there is, I want to say some words of one of the guys that was on the board of the CBO. When you talk to a coach, you're trying to be clever, you're trying to get the story, and he's making all the dough and he's got the position. When a senator talks to this guy, the senator is talking to the hired help. The senator is the one that's been elected. I mean, I know this has all gone squirrely in the last 3 decades, but I mean, it's not, you could quote this article, we started the show, and I don't know if Hal heard this part about, it seems like the Fed over the last, really since 87, is willing to make the trade-off of fixed asset prices, which benefits some people. They will save fixed asset prices even if it means higher inflation for other people by pouring money in the system. That's an obvious thing. It's not, I don't think it's out of range for you to ask the guy looking for a job that's the hired help, basically, to say, that's been the policy for a long time, it's clear to everybody, but it's caused these kinds of issues. Asset prices are maybe higher than they ought to be, and inflation's higher than it ought to be. What is your views on that? I don't see how that's a bad question, to be honest with you.
It's not a bad question. It's just one that you're not going to get an answer. So my question is: do you want an answer, or do you want to make sure you get to ask the question the way you want to ask it?
All right.
Well, that was just something I learned. Go ahead, Hal.
These politicians aren't interested in answers. I mean, if you just watch them questioning, they're not questioning, they're just reading some script that their staff put together, and then they always ask, hey, yes or no, you know. So they're not interested in answers. They want to get their they're hoping that their you know, soapbox. Their 5-minute soapbox gets on the news that night. So there's none of this. It's all theater.
Well, you know,
I mean,
yeah, that's why I said it's all a social media app.
Yeah, they want clicks. You know, most articles today that are written and published on the internet are driven for clicks. And these Republicans and Democrats that quiz administration people regularly or during these confirmation hearings are interested in answers. And the problem with the whole thing is the economists that are working for the Republicans or the economists that are working for the Democrats, they both kind of think, I think, that the Federal Reserve is like some kind of free market institution, or they believe that it can do what the Fed says it can do. And you know, if you grow up in Idaho and your parents are, you know, relatively, you know, self-sufficient and they're libertarian in most things, but they vote Republican, and you go off to college, you end up studying economics and you decide to get a PhD in economics, well, you're going to drift toward the monetary school, the neoclassical school, and they think there's a place for the Fed. If you grew up on the Upper East Side of New York with all that government infrastructure, those bridges, those tunnels, all this government welfare programs, you kind of think the state is really necessary and you appreciate the state. And you're probably going to be drawn to Keynesian or butt-in schools. And you're going to end up working for a Democrat politician. And you, of course, want the Fed to lower interest rates to make buying stuff cheaper. So the group of people that are working for these people are going to think that the Federal Reserve is this great institution, this oracle that can manage a $28 trillion economy. It's just completely ridiculous. Well, they have way too much faith in these people.
Well, can I lob a criticism out there? Not a criticism, but basically the three of us. When we say stuff generally like, the politicians don't know crap, they're just worried about their own. I'm going to make we've talked about this on several levels.
They're just interested in getting reelected.
Let me finish. We run the risk, because of TV, probably because of TV, we run the risk not the risk, I'm over the top on this, and I think you guys are worse, man, but I'm with you. You run the risk of the people who you see that seem to have the power are the, quote, politicians. And yet I was fortunate for the year or two that we did this stuff.
Well, I think most of those politicians are probably just puppets.
Okay.
There's something else behind the string pulling. That's why my money in banking class, Tom, I play Master of Puppets by Metallica all the time.
Right.
Whenever I'm in macro and we're talking about tax cuts and increased government spending or lower interest rates, I play Master of Puppets by Metallica.
Okay, but
and my students will contact me on Facebook or something on Twitter or on LinkedIn and say, "Hey, I remember that time you were playing Master of Puppets and Money and Banking."
All right, but you're. I think we're all confusing politicians by, quote, where the power is. And what I'm saying, if you look at
it's not with the politicians.
I mean, what I'm saying, when you look at the people that I met, all right, and some of the people I met in Indiana, Kevin's favorite state, and this whole idea.
Indiana's getting the Bears, right, Kevin?
No, they're not actually. Illinois is going to do.
They're not going to get the Bears.
No, I still think they're going to wind up in Arlington Heights.
Okay.
Which is a bad idea. Well, that's another subject. But I think what's happening here is we always see is what we see on TV. Yet I watched some stuff on YouTube, nothing. But I think that the in some areas, not maybe here in Chicago, or certainly not maybe in New York, I don't know what the hell AOC does, but in these other areas of the country, the representatives are very close to the people. And the idea, what I'm talking about, we're making the Fed and the power behind them is making the decision that we will always save the stock market and let inflation be damned, which I think is pretty obvious to everybody.
Definitely.
So, but I think there's a backswell to that. I saw this YouTube thing, and there's a guy in, I don't know where the hell he is, Oklahoma or someplace. He's a representative, or where there was a special election or something. Nobody ever shows up for his like weekly meeting. all of a sudden the place was SRO. I think people, and I met some of these guys in Washington, you wouldn't believe they were representative. One guy was from rural South Carolina. He was asking me for Cub tickets if he came to Chicago. I mean, we're not talking about a guy who's coming to Chicago on his private jet. You know, hey, if I get up there, could you get me some Cub tickets? Sure, why not? I mean, but the those guys, I think, and ladies, are being inundated by people that are being harmed by this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether now, I think another discussion the three of us maybe want to have one day is, where is the delineation? We probably would like Wayne on with this. And we've had Carl talk about it. People can get elected to be representatives and spend 4 and 6 years and never be anywhere near close to power. The only thing you can do is screw up if you don't vote for your party. Yet somewhere along the line, there's a few people that seem to be aligned with people outside that have a lot of the power. But I think right now, you're going to find that the people on the bottom end of this K that are going to run away, they are in their own way. I'll bet the amount of phones going off the hook in any kind of a normal representative before this election is 10 times what it was 5 years ago or 6 years ago.
Well, I think a lot of Trump's voters and a lot of Mondami's voters are feeling this rage that Marx felt. Marx wasn't criticizing, I don't think he was criticizing the free market libertarian, like, economy, free exchange, voluntary exchange economy. He was raging against the mercantilism, which got worse and worse and worse the more eastward you got in Europe. He was feeling the rage. And I think all these people who vote for Trump and Mondami or AOC, they're enraged. They feel the same kind of rage that Marx felt, because we all kind of know that this system is set up where the government creates these monopolies through regulations and licensing and con laws and competitors' vetoes. We feel that. You know, you drive up and down the turnpike, and if you don't have your Easy Pass set up on a credit card and you don't have any money on it, and then you call and you put $200 on it on the moment you're on the turnpike, you're going to be hit with fines and as you drive along the turnpike, because they don't make the money available to the Easy Pass for 4 days. Why? Because they have a monopoly of payment,
right,
on that turnpike. That's the kind of stuff that people are outraged by. And the Federal Reserve is a banking cartel. It is a banking cartel. And the Congress and the president, whether Democrat or Republican, can't even audit the thing. They can't even crack open the books.
Well, for 95% of what they do.
Building contracts.
But for 95% of what they do, I mean, it's amazingly valuable.
Yeah.
In terms of clearance check. I got a question. Kevin, explain to me, what's the best way to ask this question? When the numbers are getting so big for some people, people just lock out of their ability to even understand what the hell we're talking about. I mean, you can talk about, only the policy part of it, you can talk about, somebody here illegally, for instance, that cheated on his Social Security. Everybody can grab onto that. Hey, man, that bastard shouldn't be here. Okay, that's easy, and most people probably wouldn't even disagree. Yet when you come to what you've been sending around, hell, with Amazon all of a sudden, pressuring prices at other places, it's like the start of the show. If you had $1 million, I'll give you a personal example of how somebody could be looked at like the rat at Wrigley, only not as cute. I was at I was on the board, right? And we're talking about how much money we're going to give this new guy coming in, the new chairman, who, by the way, I didn't like in the first place. So they go through his deal, he's going to have 2 club memberships, and, the guy couldn't play golf his life dependent, but he needed 2 club memberships. But the one that got me, and this just shows what a schlump I was on the South Side, they were going to give him $10,000 to pay for his tax return to be done. And it kind of was a straw that broke my back. I go, wait a minute. We're going to pay the guy so much dough that we got to pay his accountant because it's so complicated. You should have seen the looks from all the other people in the room, the big shots. That's why you don't have blue-collar people from the South Side on boards. They ask stupid questions like that. Well, who cares about 10 grand? Or, for me, 10 grand was 10 grand. Nobody ever paid for my taxes. Just the idea that I brought that out showed them how I didn't even belong there. I mean, Kevin, am I right or wrong? I mean, it's...
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, it is in many ways. It's all about, you're in the club. You're not there for governance. You're in the club. Yeah. And so if you want to be a good club member, you go along.
And the funny thing is, we were at a Girl Scout event last night, and it was Earth Day, right? And what the girls did is they cut out these leaves after these maple leaves, and they colored them, and then when they stuck them onto this cardboard, like, recycled thing to make it look like a tree with branches, they'd have to read a blurb. And I'm not in the club, because I'm sitting there going, I'm talking to my wife, and my wife is just shaking her head and rolling her eyes, and somebody said, well, if the tree is next to the window, grades go up. And I'm whispering to my wife, and I'm like, no, the schools that are in wealthier neighborhoods that are going to have trees near them, poor neighborhoods aren't going to have any trees in the urban center of the city, and the people with income are going to be spending more time with their kids. They're going to make them read. They're going to have better teachers, and that's why the grades tend to be higher. So every time they brought up like some statement about how trees cause this and trees cause that, I'm sitting there shaking my head, and I'm like thinking, man, I wish I could get up there and just start talking. But if I started talking, they'd probably run out, or they'd probably string me up on some.
They would have no idea what the Austrian School of Economics was. You started talking.
I mean,
they think it's a bunch of people that speak English funny, and they're in the other. They're in the Southern Hemisphere.
Do you think? What do you think, Hal? Kevin, can you even imagine Hal lecturing to a bunch of 6-year-olds? Or to teachers?
I wanted to get up there and say, hey, before the discovery of oil in Pennsylvania, the eastern seaboard was deforested because firewood, was the most important energy source for colonial America and pre-fossil fuel. So it was actually a good thing that we discovered fossil fuels. Otherwise, we'd have no trees in America. But I couldn't say that either, because everybody would be outraged by what I say.
Well, that's the truth. Plus, don't forget, we didn't deforest the chestnuts. Somebody brought some virus. You still can't grow a chestnut tree, can you?
Yeah.
What? I mean, how does this come together? I mean, we see...
And so it's a really funny world that I live in, because every time people say something, I'm like, dude, you're mixing up causation and correlation. And I try to point that out. In a simple regression that I use all the time, winning percentage and hot dog sales. Because somebody might look at that data and go, hey, we can win more games by selling more hot dogs. No, you can't, because you've mixed up causation and correlation. Winning percentage causes attendance to rise, and higher attendance causes hot dog sales to rise. People will mix that up all the time, and there are very smart people with PhDs that mix that up.
Speaking of which, we had Jimmy on the show yesterday, and I don't know why he was telling me on the way in. I was going to reserve 2 minutes for it. He was going to give the report from Wrigley. I think he said, Kevin, 4 hot dogs was $60.
Oh, man.
Something along those lines.
I was listening to a tweet.
$15 good.
Yeah.
I read a tweet last night from a black conservative. I think he works for The Blaze, but he's on Twitter a lot. And he said that Caitlin Clark effect is over because the Indiana Pacers or Indiana, what's that team? Indiana.
Well, I don't know.
Caitlin Clark's team.
I know, Kevin. What's the name of that team?
The Fever.
Oh, okay.
They can't sell any tickets. They have to discount the tickets. Well, one person on that thread said, well, that's because the ticket prices are $795. Of course they're going to have to discount those tickets. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I wouldn't pay $80, $40 for an NBA ticket. There's no way I'm going to spend $7.95 for a Caitlin Clark Fever ticket. I mean, it's outrageous what these ticket prices are. And when you think demand is that high and you put out a price of $7.95 for the first home game of the year for the Caitlin Clark Indiana Fever, guess what? You're on a point on the demand curve where very few people are willing to pay that price, willing and or able to pay that price. So the Caitlin Clark effect is not over. It's just the Indiana Fever have underestimated demand.
Well, they also have a way to skew, and I wish I, you know, Kevin, once in a while, I wish I was a PhD guy with a bunch of people under me that are trying to be PhDs where I can tell them what to do and do all these great studies, and I wouldn't have to do it, right?
Well, that's kind of funny. At these R1 universities, the top universities, my co-author and I, on a couple papers we're doing this year, him and I were talking about that yesterday morning. At North Carolina A&T, we have to do research, and we have to publish in highly ranked journals, but we don't have teams of PhD candidates to help us with that. So we have to do the lit reviews. We have to, you know, come up with the policy questions. We have to collect the data. We have to clean the data. We have to estimate the models. We've got to write the paper up. But at these really large R1 universities, they have teams of PhD candidates. And when I was teaching at Duke during the summer for the American Economic Association summer program that encouraged young people, women and people of color to pursue a PhD, I was shocked by the Duke professors because they kind of let me know what really goes on. They have teams of PhD candidates in their graduate level courses running thousands of regressions. And what the professor does is they manage the process. They do the lit reviews, yeah. They estimate models, and they pick 8 of the models out of 1,000. And they cherry pick 8 of them because it tells a story that they want. And then that's what gets published. So they're essentially data mining. And we don't have that luxury at A&T.
Stupid question, Harold, and maybe Kevin. If you endow a professorship, like George Stigler and Milton Friedman were on, and they were in endowed professor spots, does the amount of the endowment...
Or Walter E. Williams at George Mason.
Yeah, well, does the amount of money you pony up for the professorship, does that include the 3 or 4 people that may be, you know, PhD candidates or something that I'll use the term he gets to order around, but are his assistants, does that include, or is that totally separate budget?
I just think it depends on where the university, what university we're talking about. If we're talking about an R1 premier economics department university, then it's probably going to include, you know, a couple of people to help that person publish. You know, the funny thing is AI has made it, has leveled the playing field a little bit.
Well, you know, it's
yeah, because it'll do the work of many people, so.
Yeah, and AI, even though I always talk about AI being like the smartest 12-year-old you're going to run across because it believes everything on the internet, you can manage it in a way where you can help that 12-year-old not believe everything they read on the internet.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the trick to AI. You have to manage it like you would manage any employee.
Yep.
And in fact, you have to manage it better than most employees because it can be very smart and it can be very stupid, but whatever it does, it's going to do it at the speed of light.
Yeah. And it never takes a break. It's like the Terminator. It will not stop until you are dead.
Well,
you know what I'm saying? It will not stop.
Without taking a Luddite shot against AI, a lot of times what you're doing, Hal, what people are researching, the reason why you're researching it is because it's not obviously available on the internet.
Yeah.
So AI might be able to help, but it might be from documents that aren't even on the internet, right?
Yeah, I generally use about 3 or 4 AIs to assist in research. And, like, for example, this is how I used it for one of my publications or one of my recent submissions. I had the final paper in Word. I got to format it according to the journal specifications. So I copied the journal specifications from the journal's website and I dropped that into a prompt and I say, hey, I've uploaded the paper. Can you read it and then go through and make sure that the current version of the paper satisfies the journal guidelines? And then it reads it really fast and it comes up and it says, I think you got to fix this, this and that. And then I go out and fix it and I just keep doing that until it has nothing else to share with me. No more improvements or enhancements. And then, and that might have taken me a week before AI. Now that took me about 3 hours to do on a Wednesday afternoon.
Okay.
That's how I use. That's kind
of
how.
Yeah,
I,
that's an effective use of the tool.
Yeah, that's kind of how I use it. I do the same thing with lit reviews. Like I'll have Google Scholar. Google Scholar is really good. It finds all this peer reviewed research, and I'll type in, you know, the kind of literature, the research questions and the data and the testing. I load that in there and I say, hey, spit out a bunch of papers. It spits out a bunch of papers and I go through it and I'm looking for just the peer reviewed articles. And then, Google Scholar has summaries, but I'll download the paper and I'll feed it into the AI and then I'll say, hey, summarize this article regarding the research question, the methods, the data sources, that kind of thing into a half page summary. And then I'll compare that to what Google Scholar has. And then I'll take whatever that is and I'll start writing it into the lit review.
Well, to get back to our baseball question, actually, Kevin brought up.
Yeah, and I got to wrap up. So ask it and then I'm going
to
go.
Well, I'm saying when you look at, it's kind of a preamble to this, Kevin, unfortunately. When you look at the people that are sitting at Wrigley, it's kind of the combination of everything we've talked about, you and I, for the last three times you're on. When you look at the people buying the tickets, and I kind of know this because one of my friends got it right from the top. What's the name of the people that own the place? Who owns the Cubs? I'm going to brain fart here.
Ricketts.
Ricketts. So my buddy is not necessarily a huge friend of Ricketts, but let's just say there was a connection between his sister and a sister of this guy's wife to the point where they introduced Ricketts to his wife in the bleachers. He always talks about he met his wife in the bleachers. He was introduced by his sister and his sister of this guy's wife. So there's a connection. And he was talking to him about how where you actually get all the money and these tickets and who's sitting where. And when you talk about baseball, he said it's 60% of the tickets, I think was the number. Don't hold me to it in a lie detector, but 60% or 65% of the tickets there were not purchased originally by the person sitting there. You got the corporate, you've got the idiots like me who used to be a season ticket holder who essentially, in economic terms, hell, is I'm a wholesaler for the guy, right? There's no way I can put my behind in the seat 81 games, so I'm selling some of them. So I'm really buying them from him as a bulk, so he knows what he's got. He's got his money up front, and it's up to me to distribute them if I can. And the team was so crappy a few years that I couldn't distribute them, and I said, screw this, we're not doing it anymore. Well, actually, Big Don did that, said that. But you also, evidently, Kevin, there's about, and Hal, there's a bunch of seats right behind home plate that are like the prime seats.
Well, they're the camera seats.
No. I'm not talking about the, well, they're just, they're not those seats, the scout seats or whatever, where the booze and all that stuff's included, but really good seats that go unsold under the intention of, you know, Boeing or somebody calling up saying, hey, I got 15 people from out of town. We really need good seats today. Hmm. And the price of those seats might be, I don't even want to pick it, might be $500 a seat. But they're willing to pay that one time. So he says an amazing percentage, you know, not 90%, but a good percentage comes from the sale of those seats on big days. Some days, I guess nobody sits there. But there's all this different. The only people that are, I'll use the term real people, were schlumps like me and Big Dan that had four seats in the upper deck and gave them out to regular people. Sold them to regular people that needed five games, eight games, or something like that. I was a source for a lot of guys on the training floor. Hey, Chief, you got the tickets next week? Yeah. I never scalped them or anything. They paid me for just face price. I'm a wholesaler, really. But it's all about, it's like the you know, Tommy Shanahan's got bear tickets.
Yeah, but you had to pay the tax, right?
That wasn't much tax.
You had to pay the tax. If you were licensed.
But the tax is on a ticket. It's all the gross number of tickets.
Excuse me, Tom. You didn't get the question out. I got to go.
I'm saying there's a lot of research into the scarcity, the idea that people want to go only one game or willing to pay up. They wouldn't do that all year. There's a million different economic questions involving a successful football or baseball team, right?
Yes.
It's not just going to the
I
food
still
store.
Gotta go.
All right, so buddy, you take care. Enjoy yourself. And hell, these are all kind of questions. Now, but if you break down to the point where the corporation says, I don't need these seats anymore, all of a sudden you got a big problem. And that's what's happened in St. Louis, essentially.
Yeah.
Their season ticket load dropped from, like, you know, 30 or 28 down to like 15. You're never going to get that many people coming up the day of the game to buy that seat.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like what's going on with MBA programs. Firms used to pay for the MBA programs. And I don't know, four, maybe five, 8 years ago, when I was at a university in Utah, our enrollment dropped off the cliff because firms stopped paying the tuition of the MBA program. So now people want to get an MBA at some of the smaller schools. They have to pay it out of pocket, and it's harder to put students in the chairs when that goes on. So I think eventually what's going to happen is maybe just like, you know, an employer paying for the MBA tuition, maybe what happens is you probably maybe start seeing less of this, like, ticket purchasing by corporations. I don't know.
Well, you didn't.
I just don't understand how anybody can go to those games. I don't know how they can do it.
Well, baseball, at least.
The parking, the hot dog, the beer, the ticket.
Well, the one thing, if you're going to Wrigley, you take the L. You don't have to park. I mean, that's the beauty of it. And in Sox Park, you can take the L. You don't have to. But when you mentioned that, if you listen to my, I'll keep it brief today. I was trying to make a correlation between just what you're saying, MBA programs, and maybe even law programs, but MBA programs might be better, and who pays for what. When I got out of University of Chicago, I'm going to say it was $3,200 a year. So my total cost was $6,200. Actually, it was less than that because I saved $500 by going in the summer, taking two classes and finishing early. So my total cost was under $6,000 for a two-year MBA.
Wow.
And which, by the way, is appreciably less than one class now.
No, yeah.
And you have to take 20 classes. So let's say the multiplier on that is 20 times. And I'm going to say the CPI from 1976 to now is what? Maybe
30?
Three times?
Yeah.
I could do that here.
Three times, yeah. Probably three times.
It might be more than that. But I'll do that here.
Well, it was 100 in 1984. And what is it now? 380? 390?
I'll find it. Whether or not, I mean, we're not bad at you know, doing
this. It's probably a factor of four, at least, at minimum. Because you weren't at getting an MBA in 1930. You're getting in the 1970s, right?
No, not 1930. I'd know more, but I'd look a little weird, probably, if I was still alive from then. Anyway.
Just give me our time.
I know. But I'm saying what we saw sort of like in the what's going on, I think, now in college sports is when I graduated, you know, my first job was the Allied Van Lines, and I went to Pullman. Every company, no matter who you were, if you wanted to go to MBA school at night, God, that's horrible. 20 classes at night, that's brutal. They would just say, oh, we'll pay for it. There was never any issue because it was $6,000. Then all of a sudden it became $8,000. Then it became $10,000. And finally, the companies would still pay for it, but they go, no, wait a minute. Mr. Hal, we'll pay for your MBA, but by the way, you got to hang in here a year after you get it. You can't just, the minute you get it, start interviewing and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then it became, you know, $20,000, and maybe people are saying, yo, it's 3 years or something like that, right? You know, it's not, it's just like, you know, colleges now paying these kids way more than they ever used to. Not getting into the argument whether they ever, you know, paid them anything, but the idea being is when people will adjust, right? Companies will adjust. Now, I'm not paying $40,000 or something, or $200,000 for you to go get another job. I mean, I'm not going to do that. So you owe me 5 years if I pay for it. Right? I mean, that's what you see happening. And a lot of times, there was a... I'll give you a... Here's a question for you, Mr. O'Connor.
Essentially, they want a buyout, right? If you leave...
Well, yeah, but here's a question.
Get a buyout, yeah.
Mr. Economist, if there was a... when we had a lady here who was brilliant on the internet when before anybody even was, she would, matter of fact, she ended up going to be a professor at DePaul and teaching people how to market and stuff over the internet. Terrific lady. Anyway, so she would put my stuff out, my quotes out from the show back in the day when I was on with Jan. And she put out, when the thing happened, 9/11. Not 9/11, the 2008 fiasco.
Yeah, the financial crisis.
Yeah, and Bear Stearns puts, stock was trading like, 60 or something, on Thursday before expiration. And the 30 puts, 35 puts for like the next day were trading $3-4. And they were talking about maybe, somebody having insider information or something like that. And my opinion was on the show that somehow got, went viral, but viral back in those days wasn't viral like it is now, was the only way anybody would do that is if they had inside information. Nobody would pay $5 for a put $30 out of money with 12 hours to go, unless you knew something, right? That wasn't published. I mean, duh. And so she Googles the thing, my name, I don't ever Google my name, but she used to. And my name came up on a final exam from a professor at Notre Dame. Did he use he used my quote as a question in a like in an ethics test? Is this guy right? I mean, and if you had that information, would it be right for you to trade? And so one of my reunions was that year, so I tracked the guy down. I said, hey, would you like to have a cup of coffee? Sure. By the way, January of 1976 till now, it's inflation is 6 times higher.
But I'm
I'm saying the...
That's if you believe the CPI number.
Well, but I'm going to say in 76, a real nice car was $2,800.
Yeah.
So it's 15 times that. So in the University of Chicago education is 25 times that. So the 6... although it's impressive, is clearly not the number. Anyway, so I said to the guy, he goes, this is the most, in those days, they didn't have courses, and when I say this wasn't that long ago, but it wasn't my latest reunion either, so it was a while, probably 4 reunions ago. And he says the single most money-making thing for the university. Remember, before you had internet's classes on the internet, you had those, like, satellite locations?
Yeah, yeah.
Where, Notre Dame Business School would have a storefront, say in Schaumburg or someplace. Just a storefront, a strip mall. And inside would be a classroom. And it was room for 25 people. And they'd have the screens up there. It was essentially the equivalent of Hollywood Squares. Where if somebody asked a question, the camera in that place would zero in on him, and he could answer the questions at 15 or 20 satellite locations around the country. And like I said, this was probably 20 years ago, the guy goes, you're saying tuition is too high, because he goes, I listened to your show. He goes, you know what, we're turning people away. Why is it too high? Which is an interesting economic question, by the way. And he says, those people pay like $6,000 a course. Because our cost to do that is like $400. And he goes, but the problem is some of the companies, like you're saying, are not wanting to do it so much anymore. Because, here's Hal talking 20 years ago. Evidently, when it got to $6,000 a course, some of the companies said, wait a minute, that's kind of a lot. Maybe you can go here to DePaul or someplace. I don't know. But there is some level that even somebody who can deduct it. Now, you and I, me coming out of Notre Dame, if the tuition was that high, I couldn't deduct it. But a university can deduct, or a company can deduct it. So then you get into this tax issue. They get really a 25 or 30% discount on it, which is another problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can't talk for 2 seconds without running into another problem, can we?
Yeah. Well, that's what Hayek pointed out in The Road of Serfdom. When government interferes, it creates consequences. And each of those consequences have to be either the only way to get rid of them is to remove that intervention that caused them, or create new policy for each of those unintended consequences. And if you just assume every intervention has two, then, you know, two consequences becomes four, right? Four becomes eight, eight becomes 16. And if you look at the Federal Registry, this is actually in my macroeconomics book that I wrote for MBA programs back in 2013. If you look at the pages of the Federal Registry, it grows geometrically. And then I overlaid that graph with economic growth rates, and you see the economic growth rate slow because of, I believe, all these regulations that end up being a monopolizing vehicle because they inhibit companies from entering a market.
Without a doubt. I mean, very interesting difference between listening to the conversation, not just listening to the person, but Russell and Larissa ran on Wednesday, and then Lou was on yesterday talking about what he's seeing in Vietnam and Cambodia and those places, and how everybody essentially wants to get a stall in the market, they get a stall in the market. You know, whether they borrow the money from somewhere or someplace or whatever, the economic ability appearingly to get into the business, there's not a whole lot of barriers to entry. I don't know what was Lewis saying.
Hong Kong used to be like the business license was, what I read was like a postcard.
Yeah.
And the now Hong Kong business license application, yeah.
But then, like Russell, we were talking sort of the same thing that you and I and Kevin were talking about today. There's this concentrations of stuff where some people are making so much dough that other people can't even understand it. And you essentially have a government, for lack of left, right, whatever it is, that is willing. I mean, I think the conclusion of all we talk about is the government right now is willing to always land policy on the side of the people that have all this dough. The other people have zero voice. I think they do have a voice, and it's starting to be heard at the lower levels, like in the representatives you don't even know about. They're starting to hear this stuff probably loud and clear. They have no ability to do anything about it. I mean, they're not going to stop the Fed, this guy or the next guy, from if the market's down 10%, pouring money into the system and saying, let inflation be damned. They're powerless to do that. So somebody is behind this curtain. And Russell was saying, it's not going to be like any kind of, you know, election revolution. It's not going to be finally decide that Amazon is a massive antitrust violator with the stuff you and Carl were going back on, and somehow putting people in jail or telling the people on the board they can't be on the board again. Nothing like that is ever going to happen. And Russell's not a violent guy at all. He's probably one of the tamest guys I know. He goes, we're talking about 1789 in France. That's how far this is going to go before people say finally enough.
Yeah.
And the 30 senators, 50 representatives, the goons in the White House, whoever they happen to be, whatever party, and maybe the 50 biggest people that own these industries are all going to be marched up to a guillotine, which I hope not, because it's that out of control. There's no way right now that it can come back in a normal manner where regular people can say, wait a minute, that's a little too much. I mean, even the
well, that's Marx's rage, right?
Yeah.
That I mentioned earlier, that's Marx's rage. People are feeling this rage, and they're going to elect somebody who they feel is going to rage against the machine. One of my favorite songs, by the way.
How's that ever going to happen, Noel? Because if you ran, and I know you have that moral fiber, and I have a feeling you're a loving father and you love your wife, I'm going to say that if you ran with that ticket, you're going to find out that you not only messed with but abused five women you never even met, and you're never going to be able to defend it.
Yeah.
Because that's the power of the other side, of the dark side, at this point.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure that AI, with all these deep fake videos that, you know, AI can make now. I mean, I don't think they're very impressive now, but in 3 or 4 years, a deep fake video is going to be really good. And all you need today in today's, you know, media landscape is, you know, the video to basically Mike Tyson uppercut you and knock you out.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to overcome and defend yourself from something like that.
Well, but if they can accuse me of messing because around with
your
some
opponents are just going to run with it on Twitter, or if you're critical of the left, man, they're gonna run over the top of you. If you're critical of the right, you're gonna get run over. So you're gonna get run over by the media, and it takes a certain kind of person to be able to withstand all that and stand up to it. And I don't know if there's
well, I don't think you have the money to.
Yeah. Well, right now, I mean, the federal government has convinced us all that debt is great, that savings is bad. And if you save, you get punished because you're making a negative, you're earning negative interest when you account for inflation. So they got us all believing that consumption is great. We're all in debt, and they don't need to, you know, put you in concrete galoshes and drop you at the bottom of the river or throw you over the cliff like they do in Yellowstone, the TV series.
Yeah.
You can just lose your job. And then once you lose your job, you can't pay that mortgage, you can't pay off those credit cards, you can't pay off your car. So you got, that's how they get you to toe the line to some degree.
Well, if they accuse you, or the allegations, those alligators accuse you 30 years ago of messing around and abusing with some lady you never even met, what's your defense?
Yeah. Think about this. Bill, you know, no matter what you think of Bill Cosby, there were more bigger monsters than Bill Cosby, according to court cases and whatnot. And, you know, I'm just saying, he was a monster, right?
Yep.
What he did. But there were bigger monsters who actually bragged about doing what Bill Cosby was accused of and convicted doing. There were bigger monsters doing that. The media interviewed Hugh Hefner. And he told the interviewer I watched the video, that he would use Quaaludes to have sex with his Playboy bunnies. He called them thigh spreaders. And there was no outrage over that. He didn't have to, like, go to jail. He was admitting to it in a news interview, and nothing was done. Why did they go after Bill Cosby? Because Bill Cosby's TV shows show a father who's not a buffoon, and it's funny, and there's two parents, and the kids and the parents love each other. That's why he was taken down, in my opinion. I'm not saying what he did was not wrong. I'm just saying the justice was selective, and you got to ask why. Why wasn't Hefner thrown in jail? Because he admitted to it in interviews of what Bill Cosby was convicted of doing.
Well, I'm not going to. This is not a sexual thing of one side or the other. Yeah. It is something that I think could be predicted.
I think what goes on is they get the goods on you, and then they can bend you to their will.
I was going to go to another direction here. When you talk about who's the guy they're retrying again, the guy from. Who used to essentially have sex with the people getting roles. That was his name. He was the head producer of, was it NBC or one of those places?
Oh, the guy in the Today Show?
Yeah, what was his name?
Matt Lauer?
No, the real ugly guy that's in jail and not retrying him again.
Oh, yeah. Weinstein?
Yeah, Weinstein. Oh, hey, Weinstein. John, how are you?
Morning, Hal. Morning, John.
I asked John to pile in a little bit, Hal, to help us out.
Oh, yeah, no problem, yeah.
So, you, economically, you got a role in a movie, be it guy or girl. I mean, in those days, it was more the girl, but I've heard rumors that it's now it happens to guys. You got 10 ladies out there, all of which are making, you know, all the rice they can eat, doing God knows what now, and here's a role worth $500,000. Now, if somebody lets on that if something went with it, you might move to the front of the line. It has happened. Okay, let's just say it's happened. It happens to guys, I think, in the music industry. When someone, maybe the people in the music industry.
Yeah, there's a lot of.
There's a lot that's going on. So, I mean, if people were making a regular wage and the job was, if everybody's making 60 and the job was 75, I'm going to say nobody would do something like that. But it's an amazing life-changing experience if you're the chosen person. And the people who are sleazebags, of which there are all kinds of them, are either going to, A, maybe demand sex, maybe they're going to demand you to mow the guy's lawn for 6 months. Whatever it is, somebody is going to make, there's going to be a fee to this. And the example I'm using, Helen, I'm not trying to be some pervert here, but I'm saying on the CBOE floor versus the CME floor and the Chicago Board of Trade, and you could use this for one of your classes, and I think John will find it when you trade in a trading crowd and you made a trade yourself, okay, there was a clearing fee you paid to, it was 20 cents a contract or whatever, to your clearing firm, because they had to clear it and all the other stuff they paid for your insurance. If you left an order in another crowd, say I want to buy two of these at X and sell one of these at X, and I left that order in the IBM crowd, I'd have to give it to another broker, and he would work the order for me because I wasn't there. Well, now you have to pay the broker. And the going fee was $1 a contract, which was a little high as time went by, as volume picked up. So on the CBOE, they said, okay, people can discount that number, even though that was the published number. So if I got a bill from somebody that I made a lot of business with for $1,000 in a month, I could discount it, say, 25%, and that was all okay. Or he might even write on there, minus 25. But that was the going rate. There were a couple of guys that didn't want to do it, but they were, you know, whatever. But CME and the CBOT, they did not allow that at all. So you had a difference between the market rate is, say, 70 cents, published rate is a buck. Now, the three of us, having some economic knowledge, all of a sudden, there's all kinds of fingers in the pie there, mm-hmm. where the clerk who gets the business say, "I want 15 cents a contract because I got you the business." If you shoved an order from, if you got just a general order from a firm and there were three brokers competing for it, if you handed the ticket when you walked out to the crowd to a certain broker and gave it to him instead of the other guys, you might want 10 or 15 cents kickback, and you're just a runner. So there were all kinds of, even there was like some innuendos of mob influence and so forth among the clerks, which never would have happened if the guy in the crowd, if the price was just 65 cents. Like, if you really wanted to, in George Stigler's words, if you really want to stop corruption in politics, like you were always trying to do, Hal, and you too, Jen, if you went out for bid for a repair of the Nan Ryan, say, if you knew exactly what your costs were, say they were $10 million. You knew that was going to cost the guy $10 million, and the bids came in and were, you know, ten came in for like $11 million, which is kind of a fair profit. If you call that guy up and say, "I need this much for my campaign," the guy's going to go, "I don't have it. It was a fair price." Now, if somehow or another the guy can figure out a way to get $15 million for that, you know that you've got $4 million in the other guy's pocket that you can tap. So if you call up and you want John Flanagan to be a judge, you call a guy up, or you have your guy call up his guy and say, "Okay, John Flanagan is having his benefit. We need 10 tickets at $50 a pop." And the guy goes, "That's okay." So you're not part of the money taking. You just know all the people that owe you. This is big. And a guy like you, Al, could probably put some of this on a regression analysis and actually explain it all. But you know what I'm talking about. If everything was priced fairly, you probably wouldn't have women accusing guys of doing stuff, guys accusing guys of doing stuff, and, oh, by the way, some clerks hitting people up for money in the Board of Trade floor. To me, this all kind of ties together. Tell me where I'm nuts.
Well, you mentioned political corruption. You can't, I firmly believe, you can't root out the political corruption when people are elected every 6 years or every 4 years or even every 2 years, because what happens is a person who's really corrupt in a heavily blue state or a heavily red state, they're going to get reelected no matter what happens every 2 years, 4 years, or 6 years. So they're going to get reelected.
You're not right on that. There's been a huge turnover in the House.
I know,
in the last 10 years.
I'm talking about the people in the heavily blue and heavily red states.
The people that we see on TV, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah. So in a marketplace, if you're corrupt or unethical and you rip people off, people find out very quickly, and they can elect to stop doing business with you the moment they find out that you're like that. In politics, you have 1 year as a congressperson to help people forget what you did. As a senator, you have 5 years. If elections could be held every day of the year for a senator or a House of Representatives, if they had to face the voters every moment of the day like a firm does, then there'd be a lot less corruption in Congress. So I think the more one party a state is, and the longer the election cycle is for that particular office, that's going to it's going to make it almost impossible to root out all that corruption.
Jan, what do you think?
Well, I think you can run afoul of your opposition without even knowing that there is an opposition, because it's kind of a moving target. And I'll use the example of Bill Cosby, which I absolutely agree with you about, Hal, by the way. I mean,
yeah.
But not only was he, showing a stable family in a world where stable families were becoming scarcer and somewhat discredited, he was also taking on the whole hip-hop culture, hip-hop music, everything. The speeches he was making off the studio camera when he was doing his show were about, black youths not, following the model of prison attire.
Well, he spoke at a graduation ceremony that was at, and it was, that's exactly what he did.
Yeah. And this is the opposition that he ran up against, and it became, he thought he was doing the Lord's work, I think.
Yeah.
In trying to reorient.
Well, people will say, well,
get them off of the,
people will say, well, he did evil. People say he did evil. Well, God works through flawed people. Moses didn't think he was capable or moral enough or talented enough to carry on that message. So God works through people, and it doesn't matter who you are. You can relay a message from God, even though you're an extremely flawed person. Pastors that I've had will sit up there and say, hey, man, in my youth, I was a marijuana smoking surfer, marijuana smoking Harley biker.
What's wrong with being a marijuana smoking surfer? I would have loved to be a surfer.
What I'm saying, though, is you can be a heavily flawed person, and God can work through you. And like him or not, we don't have to, embrace what he did. But John is exactly right. They took him down because not of what he did. If they took him down because of what he did, they would have taken down Hugh Hefner, who admitted to it in a media interview on TV. So it wasn't about what he did; it was about his message.
Absolutely, and this is still a foot in the world. So, I mean, as a politician, you might think I've got to go after this, obvious corruption or this obvious decadence or whatever. I'll make my mission. And you have no idea that you're actually running up against forces far more powerful than you that want this decadence and corruption. And at the time Cosby was bucking the trend, nobody above, his pay grade wanted hip hop culture to be criticized or discredited. It was all about, I think, pacifying the worst, criminal influences, to keep, the black, power structure beholden to them and not make them a political force and make them just sort of desensitized by following, drug culture, gangster culture, abusing women. I mean, this is what's so, pathetic about the whole situation. You see it maybe as a crusade against evil A, and evil A is supported by people far more powerful than you, and they don't want the gig to be finished yet. And if you're criticizing them, they will smear you any way they can to make you impotent and get the objective they want. So it's all this shadow boxing in politics now. You have no idea who the real players are, and maybe it's just as well. Because
what does Wayne say? How many people essentially on the right that go flying up against, they can't stand any of the gay culture when half of them are gay?
Well, that's a little different. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but look, what you're talking about, what happened to Elliot Spitzer, same thing, right? Is Bill Cosby.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Elliot Spitzer, once he started saying the financial industry was behind the subprime loan scheme, and it was all about, you know, fake accounts at Wells Fargo, that was like 2 days after that op-ed piece ran in the Washington Post, he was toast.
Yep.
They threw the book at him completely.
If you want to see how this game is run by the government, you got to watch the Netflix series, The Man in the High Castle, because Hoover is portrayed as a guy that went with the Nazis when the Nazis won in this alternative world, World War II. And, man, just how they portrayed Hoover, how he can get the goods on everybody, and then if they don't bend to his will, he can expose them.
We got to go to break, guys.
They don't care about your behavior. They want to use your flawedness, your ability to commit sin. They want to use that against you to bend you to their will.
Right.
They don't care about what you did. They care about what you're going to do for them, and they're going to bend you to their will, or else you're going to die, or you're going to lose your job.
Right. They'll shut you up the easy way or the hard.
We got to go to break here, guys. And by the way, I haven't seen either one of you disappointed today with the big news that it affects, I know, the both of you. Porsche drops Bugatti. You're not going to be able to buy a Bugatti made by Porsche anymore.
Oh, what a pity.
Yeah, I don't run in those circles, Tom, so I have nothing to say about that.
When was the last time you saw a Bugatti, for God's sake?
I don't even know what a Bugatti is.
The car that the great dancer Isadora Duncan was killed by. She got her scarf wrapped around the wheel of her Bugatti.
Really?
Yeah, strangled her.
Yeah. Anyway, S&P futures up 46.
Was she too critical of somebody?
she was critical of the scarf manufacturer. S&P right. futures up 27. NASDAQ futures up 339. Get a load of this. Intel came out and said they're finally starting to show some growth. So the stock's up 25%. So that's taking AMD with it, up 11%. Now we come back, let's comment a little on these prices. These prices are other world right now. We're talking, you know, billions and billions of dollars difference in market cap. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well, don't fake Stocks and Jocks. I'm somehow Ricky on the board. I'm going here. The Intel's trailing P.E. ratio was a negative. So now they're saying they might make a little bit of money, and the stock is up like 30%, 28%. I'll get the amount of shares outstanding in a minute when Ricky's doing traffic weather. The S&P futures up 27. NASDAQ futures up 340. It's 1.25%. Way in a record territory. We're not sure why that is, but we were there. Over in Europe, DAX up 85.4%. FTSE down 24.3%. DAX down 31.4%. So maybe generally a little lower, but kind of mixed. Asia, Nikkei up 575.9%. Hang Seng up 62.2%. Shanghai down 13.3%. Asia-Pacific market trade mixed as Israel-Lebanon ceasefire extension fails to calm investors. Yeah. Calm a little bit here, I guess. 10-year, same spot, 4.31. Bonds have been very steady. Interest rates here. Oil down a buck, 94.81. We got gold up a buck, 70, 47.25. Gold's been volatile. So is silver. Maybe even a little more volatile. Up 64 cents, 76.15. Foreign exchange. The British pound is actually up a little bit today. They're 135 in the euro, 117, kind of the same. Crypto up another 449, 78,222. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in Chicago. 62 degrees right now with a high of 74. Mostly cloudy and very warm with a thunder shower this afternoon. Tonight will be clear to partly cloudy and cooler with a low of 44 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 63 degrees right now with a high of 91. Times of clouds and sun. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 66. Traffic in Chicago. There's an accident reported. Dan Ryan southbound on express lanes at 31st Street, exit 54. The right lane is blocked, so expect some heavy traffic this morning. Stevenson and Eisenhower inbound are also heavily congested at the moment. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 33 minutes, and inbound Stevenson from 294 is 31 minutes. Edens and Kennedy are moving at posted speed. Let's talk sports real quick. For the MLB, Cubs beat Phillies 8-7, and White Sox beat Diamondbacks 4-1. Today we got Nationals at White Sox at 6:40 p.m., and Cubs at Dodgers at 9:15 p.m. NHL playoffs round 1 game 3 is going on right now. Today we got Lightning at Canadiens. How do you say that anyway? Canadiens?
Yep, Canadiens.
Canadiens at 6 p.m. Golden Knights at Mammoth at 8:30 p.m. and Oilers at Ducks at 9 p.m. For the NBA, we're also on first round game 3. Today Celtics at 76ers 6 p.m. Lakers at Rockets 7 p.m. and Spurs at Trailblazers 9:30 p.m. If you're looking for a reason to raise a glass and give back, join Friends of Fisher House and Revolution Brewing for the Heroes of Four Heroes kickoff party happening Friday, May 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at their Ketsey Brewery. Swing through for food, raffles, good company, and a chance to learn about Fisher House and how they support our military. For the month of May, a portion of Revolution sales will be donated to Friends of Fisher House, providing a home away from home for veterans and military families. This event is free and open to anyone who will support. That's the Heroes for Heroes kickoff party on Friday, May 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at 3340 North Ketsey. Save the date and raise a glass for our heroes. Back to you, Chief.
We actually, a bunch of us might be going to that.
Oh, that's awesome.
And if we do, we'll make sure that you get the invite, Ricky.
Maybe I'll see you guys there.
You know, who knows? Maybe we could even lure John Flanagan. What do you think? What are the chances of that?
I'll be back to that, too.
That's even close to your house. Your excuse list would drop precipitously.
I could almost walk there.
God.
Almost.
So, Hal, what do you make of Intel maybe making some money, and now the stock is up, well, it was up more than $20. There's only 5 billion shares outstanding, so that's, what is it? $10 billion and $100 billion in market cap in one instant, because they might make a buck.
What percent up are their sales?
7%.
Oh, well, you know, that might, if inflation is around 5%, if you account for inflation, their sales are up 2%. So that's a legit number there. So normally when companies report their sales, they're up, I don't know, 2-3%, and when you account for inflation, that's either flat or declining. So that's positive for Intel.
Here's a headline that attests to you who your president is working for. Trump warns of big tariff if UK doesn't drop digital services tax on U.S. tech firms. So he's going to put a tax on the rest of American people if the UK doesn't play nice with U.S. tech firms.
Yeah.
There's a trade-off, don't you think?
You know, these tariffs were really monopolizing about the time when Sherman got his Sherman antitrust law enacted. I was actually reading an article that was published in the Public Choice Journal a few years ago, and it talked about how the Republicans were really in favor of tariffs because in America at the time, you could have these trusts, these companies buy up all their competition in a mostly market system. And then if you put a heavy tariff on firms outside the country, the domestic firm selling in that market essentially has a monopoly. So tariffs were used by Republicans to help these big corporations to maintain a monopoly position.
Well, it absolutely put us, John, we were talking about this one day. It absolutely created the garment industry here because it was all over. England had by far way ahead of us in terms of investment.
Oh, yeah, the wool, yeah. The quality of the wool, yeah.
Well, but just the machines.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was, they had the machines, and you put a big enough tariff there where people were able to develop it here. I mean, if you're one of those people.
The industrialization was so far ahead of ours, you know, the beginning of the 19th century, so.
Well, you could say that it was it worked, but who did it work for? Not you and me. If we had to buy some pants.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about Lehman Brothers Tuesday morning, Tom, and that led to us discovering why the garment industry was so big in New York City. And when my in-laws came from Haiti in the 70s, I think both of them at one point probably worked in the garment industry until they were able to secure other. And there were probably a lot of migrants in their same situation working there, and they're probably, a lot of them were probably working for cash.
Well, the garment industry was the
Duvalier's, you know, dictatorship.
It was absolutely the just like it is in other countries, or was.
Yeah.
Was the absolute leader in terms of child labor and abuses, wasn't it, Mr. Flanagan?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, you know, the women worked horrible hours, locked into their building, and fire can, you know, just wipe the, you know, the whole floor to floor of these workers, and it became this, you know, labor scandal. It started all these investigations of sweatshop conditions in New York and elsewhere, yeah.
Well, one of the biggest things economically,
how recent was that, John? Was that
1911 was the fire. Yeah.
I don't know that it's that long ago in some southern places.
Yeah.
I mean, what would you say, Jen? 30 maybe?
Well, still, I mean, it's still going on certainly elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
In even more unimaginable horror. You know?
Well, one of the counter arguments to shutting that down is, like, in a place like Thailand or someplace in that part of Asia, where these companies are really heavily criticized for the conditions that women work in, the alternative for working in a factory like that in that part of the country, and I was in the Navy and I saw it firsthand, is that the girl would either have to work in a rice paddy farm or work in a brothel. And a lot of times the parents sell their kids to these brothels. You know, so the key is economic development, and the European model it kind of prohibits economic development. You can see that in Africa, where these African nations aren't allowed to, like, drill for oil or whatnot. They're really strangled by it. So the key is development and growth. And in free markets where there are no winners and no winners picked by government, if a company does you wrong, consumers fire them at that moment. A politician has a year, 3 years, or 5 years to convince people, hey, that was a one-time thing. But a firm can lose all credibility after building up really good, great goodwill for 30 years. They can lose it all in a moment by just one decision, and people will fire that firm. Consumers are the most brutal of regulators, and that goes back to why there is political corruption, and there's going to be more political corruption the more one-sided the political process is within
the
state.
When the risk of, we don't want Hal to turn into Chevy Chase right in front of us, do we, John? Where he says to, what was his name, Bill Murray, yeah, we have a pond, a pool, the pond would be good for you. You know,
you want me to be the big toe?
Well, the
Uncle Holka, Sergeant Holka with his big toe.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want me to be the big toe?
God. Okay, he was so funny in that role, wasn't he?
Oh, man, he was funny, man. My brothers and I had every line from Stripes memorized.
Oh, God.
We had every line. That and Blazing Saddles.
when you look at these people and you make this economic argument from the highbrow kind of guys, you know, like Hal maybe, that, you know, this is good for them. And then Wayne sent me this list of all the people that governmental figures that have stolen money from the people they ruled. And by the way, Trump's moving up this chain big time, but the number one, who's the number one guy who's stolen money from his people, would you guess, say, in the last 50 years? You guys know the name right off the top of your head. The one guy they think might have cracked
well,
the trillion-dollar number.
Well, I got so many candidates, I don't know which one to pick.
Well, I'll say the numbers. These guys got the number, and he's cracked the trillion-dollar number.
Wow.
Mr. Putin.
Oh, Putin. Okay.
Yeah. But they come down to some of these people in these African countries that if you just listen to them and you see, you know, films of what's going on over there, and you see people trying to get water and, you know, God knows what basic necessities, you think, God, these people don't have anything. But you'll see the people who ran the place, like the countries in Africa right now. We're two countries are having the war now, Jen. The Pope was down there someplace trying to straighten one. Whatever.
Angola.
Was it Congo?
No, and the guy who used to run Angola's got like $100 million somewhere, or $200 million. And you sit there. How the hell do you get? Where's the place the Houthis are?
That's Oman or?
No, it's
Yemen or
whatever. The guy who used to run that place has got a couple $100 million.
I think it's Yemen.
So it's Yemen. So it's like you sit there and go, oh no, that lady. If I wasn't paying her $2 an hour to make blue jeans that I'm selling for $100, I'm doing her a favor. Wait a minute. By the way, how much are you making? Well, I'm making $200 million, but you're doing her a favor? I mean, come on.
Well, at the Girl Scout meeting last night, the last thing they shared with us is this book that was created for this Kenyan woman who apparently planted 1 million trees. And they were able to get the British out of Kenya. And then the person that replaced the British running the government was this dictator. And this dictator was proposing all these projects that would cut down all these trees. So in most cases, the state is probably the culprit behind the pollution and deforestation.
When you say the state, you're talking about it.
In the West.
And when you
we
say
had deforestation in the West because all the land out West was basically public land. And so it was land communism, which is what gave rise to the Wild Wild West and the wars between the sheep herders and the cattlemen and the people trying to farm the land. Because it was basically just, you know, public land. And the remnant of that today is BLM. And BLM, I think, owns 80% of the land in Utah to this day.
You know, like 90% there. Well, between that and Indian reservations, 90% Arizona.
Yeah. And that's why you have so much development along Interstate 15 between Ogden, Utah, and Provo. It's just one big freaking city now. There's no farmland or space between those cities. It's just one big metro area. Outside that area is basically just desert.
Chicago wilderness. Chicago and Naperville, the same thing. It used to be farmland, right, Jen?
Yeah.
Long Island.
When you say that, you know, the state, some places don't do that. Other places do. I have a friend who will go nameless, that actually had an economic or math system. One of these days, if you guys remember in town at the same time, I'd love to introduce you to her, Hal, because it's a math of the kind that I don't understand. It's a math, they call it math, but it's not coming up with an answer. You know, I was good at math where the answer is 4.2. Well, this is where you use mathematical stuff. It's sort of like maybe more like regression than it is math, where, you know, it's like the salesman coloring problem. There's no answer. There's just solving it type of thing. Anyway, it had to do with the UN wanted to take a piece of some of these lands, all these countries, and they wanted to put in a way of screening container shipments. And evidently now they got it from the army or somebody. You can take a picture of a container. This is a few years ago, so it's probably gotten even better. And in there, you don't just see that there's a sphere. It'll tell you it's a basketball because it's inflated or something. It might be a soccer ball probably. But anyway, the UN was going to try and put these at all these places to where if a container came in from Zimbabwe, say, they take a picture of it, and when it landed in New Orleans, you take another picture of it. And if the picture didn't match, if somebody put contraband on there, you rejected the thing or you searched it or something. And this was going to be some kind of a worldwide. Now, how far it ever got, I have no idea. But the UN wanted to control the demarcation point in all these countries. So they wanted to buy enough land, and it was under, this is perfect for you, Jen, for both of you guys, you're a conspiracy. It was under the UN sports thing, where the idea was they were going to get this land and they were going to put up a bunch of soccer fields or whatever, athletic facilities, going to put up a hospital, so the UN would have a hospital. They'd have, like, a spot there for UN people to hang, because the UN still does some good stuff in some of these places. And they were going to put up the investment for this whatever this thing is that took pictures of, I don't know how big it was or anything like that. So the company, the country didn't have to do it. But now if somebody came up with a shipment, you know, you got to pay for it. It was, whatever, $1,000 a picture, a container, or $500, whatever it was. Well, in order to get this to be done, when the UN is ponying up the money, the two-bit dictator would say, wait a minute, I get a cut of that. Not the state like you're talking about, Al, or not, you know, government in general.
Well,
center.
The dictator is the state.
Yeah, he goes, I get a cut of that. So they actually were putting together, and they were going to give the guy, like, you know, $5, and it was going to go in his Swiss bank account. Well, these guys got a Swiss bank account.
Yeah.
So this person that I know, she was, as soon as she heard that, she goes, I want no part of it, and she quit. She goes, I'm not doing that. And so she bailed. I don't know. And I haven't talked to her in a long time, like years. I don't know if it just the whole thing got dropped, not because she quit, but if the whole thing got dropped or became too complicated or all the other stuff going on, whether that thing ever made any progress or not. But they were, you know, it was like, what did Truman say? He's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Wasn't that the quote, John?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you only can do business with perfect people, God, hell, who would you do business with if that was your...
Well, you mentioned, today you mentioned son of a bitch and Crash Davis, Bull Durham, right?
Yeah.
My favorite quote is, the son of a bitch is throwing a two-hit shutout. He's shaking me off. You believe that?
Yeah.
Charlie, here comes the deuce.
Yep.
And when you speak of me well.
It's
and Charlie is a reference to, you know, Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
The batter's name isn't Charlie.
And the guy, of course, launches it.
Yeah.
When he came out, he said something, man, someone who moves that fast really should have a stewardess on board, don't you think?
And then Meat goes, it's almost like he knew what I was throwing. And Crash is like, I told him.
It was almost like, well, Meat was such a dummy. It's almost like I knew what he was, anyway.
That is one of the, that's probably the best sports movie of all time. I gotta say it's probably the best.
Well, the part where he was late for his first mount thing because he was having sex with the lady down in the locker room.
Yeah.
And so the manager is blustering about how I can't believe that he's down there. He's late because he's getting some piece of ass. And the girl's sitting right there. She goes, my father put up that donkey in right field. If you don't want his donations anymore, I'm not, quote, some piece of ass.
Why do you call me Meat? Yeah. I have a Porsche. I have a quadriphonic blah punk.
Yeah.
You don't need a quadriphonic blah punk. You need a curveball.
Well, talk about, you can't make movies like that anymore. But, because,
no.
Well, actually, there's a, other than everybody being so thin-skinned,
yeah.
The real reason, I think, one of John's buddies was in the movie industry. In fact, those were the guys, they were at our house in Beverly. That was a long time ago. God, years ago, decades. Who were the guys that did Blood Simple, John? Was that the Coen brothers?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, they went to school with Dr. J. One of the bros was over at our house eating pasta with me, drinking wine and watching a football game. Anyway, he said that now most of your they were really into the biggest money makers were in the horror films back in those days.
Oh yeah,
because you could put one together for next to nothing. What did the Night of the Living Dead cost? Like $100,000 or $200,000 or something.
Yeah, the quality of that movie is not pretty high.
Yeah, I mean they made a fortune. But the
what about Friday the 13th?
Yeah, well, what about
that wasn't much.
Well, yeah. none of them. Chainsaw Man. Remember all those flicks? Then they had the black exploitation flicks.
Black exploitation. Yeah. There's Foxy Brown, Shaft, all these franchises.
What was who was the guy who was always in those movies with the big time detective? What the hell was his name? The black guy always had great looking ladies in there. God bless. Anyway, there was big money in that stuff. And
yeah.
Sometimes movies now, 50% of the revenue is from overseas. So they don't, even if they want to, they don't understand our humor. They don't understand our slang.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't have any idea what Crash Durham was talking about and the stuff you just mentioned, Al.
Well, that comes up in that series I was sharing with you, the Man in High Castle. Because the Japanese are occupiers, of the western states. The Nazis are the occupiers of the eastern states. And then the Rocky Mountain region is like a neutral zone. And one of the characters that I like a lot is Robert Shilden. And he sells Americana artifacts to the Japanese. And you learn that this sense of humor that Americans have, it's really hard to understand. And you learn how that works in this series in a couple of scenes where he's trying to sell something. And the Japanese are asking these questions about why would you call somebody a bad name, bastard, who's your friend? They go, isn't that a bad word? And they're like, yeah, but you call them that because it's, kind of like funny.
Yeah.
So you use these words that mean the opposite. Or you say, pal, you better back off. Pal has a positive connotation, but in that context, it's like, you're a butthead and you better back off or I'm going to kick your butt kind of thing.
Would you ever watch the original, some of the early NCIS episodes when, what's her name, the lady from the side, Ziva? She knew five languages or something, well trained. Whenever she'd break into American slang, she had no clue.
Yeah.
One,
yeah.
She goes, your duck is cooked. Yeah, and the guy goes, no, that's a goose. What's the difference?
Well, I had friends that were from China, and they were asking me all kinds of questions about, why do you say BS? And I go, well, BS is bull, shit. Yeah. And they're like, bull poop?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would you say
Yeah, what's that have to do with anything? But,
Riding shotgun means, you're riding in the passenger seat. Do you have a shotgun? I go, no, you don't have a shotgun. We call it riding shotgun because on these wagons that they were with the horse-drawn wagons that were shipping product across the Wild West, you had to have a guy with a shotgun to shoot at any pirates on horses. And so the person riding next to you, they're riding shotgun, and they still had a hard time with that concept.
In any Western movie any of us saw, did the shotgun guy ever succeed in
Yeah, Kevin Costner in Wyatt Earp.
Oh, he actually succeeded in getting in, shooting away the bad guys?
Yeah, there was a couple times where that's why he rode shotgun. But then he was so good at riding, driving horses that he ended up driving the horse team too.
Being the driver.
Yeah, and Wyatt Earp, he was pretty good at the shotgun.
All right, we got 2 minutes, guys, to bring the whole week to conclusion, all the different stuff we talked about. John, am I just totally nuts? I mean, you're on more than most. To me, it's even the stuff we're talking about more fun, it's all the same theme. It's the article the lady wrote, the stuff Larissa was talking about, with the things she's telling people about the inflation, and we're talking about, Fed balance sheets going up. Oh, by the way, that number comes out today. I'm anxious to see it. I bet it's blowing up huge. The same thing in the article from a listener sent it, with the New York Times article. When does this K-shaped stuff end? It does. I mean, it ended in 29 horribly. I don't want to see that happen because I don't want to see, my clients get hurt. I don't want to see anybody get hurt. But I also know, I think I know, that there's an end to this. You can't just keep pouring money into, used to be 20% of the people, then it became 10, then it became 5, now it's 1. You can't just keep doing that without something happening someplace. And nobody can predict the catalyst. I can't. When does it become? I think we're getting to that fever pitch. You're starting to get regular people, and maybe I'll say regular congressmen, bitching about this. And yet, I don't see any power there. Do you? I mean, how far can we go?
Well, I think it'll happen. I think in real estate, as in 29, that was the kind of the canary in the coal mine too.
So that happened before the stock market. Real estate.
Yeah, I mean that the market was in real trouble and prices had gone sky high and yeah, the Florida land, all this fraud in the system too, but I it's happening now. I think that the market is freezing up, and it's gonna Nancy and I were talking on Monday with you, Tom, and you know, even if prices were to collapse in the housing market, I don't think that's going to affect the ability of anybody to afford a house. I think that there's so many other costs attendant on buying a house that, you know, those aren't going to come down. Insurance, rates aren't going to collapse. If anything, they'll continue to skyrocket. Taxes will continue to skyrocket. So it's not going to be correctable by a housing price collapse. And then, you know, that's different from 29. So I don't know what will happen. It's already in process now, I think.
Well, the newly printed money is trapped in the banking system for the most part because banks are allowed to pay interest on, or the Fed is allowed to pay interest on reserves. So the stuff that leaks out goes into these financial assets. So that's kind of how they've been able to bottle. If we didn't have interest on reserves, man, I think we would have pretty substantial. Well, I don't know what it would
be. I know you're on the theory side of that. And by the way, I want you to keep coming with the stuff you're doing on the banking stuff. But you don't know how right you are, by the way.
Yeah.
Because if John Flanagan were to let a couple of butterflies out of his wallet and call up PTI today and say, I want to buy 1,000 shares of IBM at 231, how much do I have to send you? Now, we don't really have any clients like this, but we would do this for John. Of course, the other places would love him because he'd make money on interest. He'd have to send me 116 grand. He just borrowed 116 grand. He could do that tomorrow. Yeah. Nobody would bat an eye. And by the way, John's a reasonable guy. He's got some dough, and he's good for it. Anybody can do that. Anybody can do that. I mean, right now we'll lend anybody, when I say we, any brokerage firm, even though Intel was up $25 and it's moved more in one day than it has in like years. If you bought that at 90, it's now 86. I mean, it's now 83, but it was trading 90, I think. If you bought that at 90,000 shares, any firm, if the 45 grand showed up, would lend you the other 45 grand. Find me a bank that if the three of us walked in and said we want to remodel a house and we need 45 grand, that gives us a loan. Nobody. Maybe they'll say, well, the three of you idiots got enough money on your credit cards. If you combine your credit cards, take out 15 grand a piece, pay 30%.
Yeah, 28% interest.
Yeah. So, when I say how you...
Well, by the way, the yield curve has been really messed up for like 5 or 6 years. I'm just looking at the yield curve right now, and it's pretty vertical. It's no longer inverted. All the short-term yields are close to the federal funds rate, and the longer the maturity, the higher it is. So the yield curve is upward sloping right now.
So how does it help the fact that Hal likes to argue with me about everything when I said he has no idea how right...
Smuggling and markets. Smuggling is just markets trying to break free of government restraints. And so markets are really resilient. Even when in an economy that's heavily controlled and restrained, smuggling happens. Black markets form. That's the entrepreneurs trying to break free of the shackles of government. And so markets will find a way. They do. They find a way. They found ways in fascist Italy.
Yeah.
They found ways in the Soviet Union.
There's always a workaround.
Try to shake free of those shackles of government.
Well, you guys, thank you very much. It's been a good week. And, Hal, I think you're absolutely right. That money comes flying out of the Federal Reserve for any kind of margin loan, right?
Yep, exactly, yeah.
Well,
but not for anything else.
No, S&P Futures up 20, NASDAQ Futures up 307. Everybody have a good weekend. Who knows, John, maybe I'll even see you. By the way, that date is May 8th, so let's kind of pencil that one in. Ricky, nice job. Back Monday, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.